Last month, the actor Gene Wilder died at the age of 83. In print and on air, writers and entertainers reflected on his kindness as well as his great talent. The Atlanta Jewish Film Festival honors the memory of Gene Wilder with a screening of four of his movies: The Frisco Kid, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Blazing Saddles, and The Producers. That takes place Sunday. Joining me now are two people from the festival: Professor Matthew Bernstein of Emory University. He's chair of film and media studies there. And Brad Pilcher, who's the associate director of the festival. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Lois. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Well, it's been less than a month since the actor passed away, and it's not easy to pull together an event like that you're presenting Sunday. When did you decide to have this celebration of Gene Wilder?
Well, I think we wanted to do this as soon as we heard the news of his passing. It's just, how could you not do this? The trick for us was trying to pull together a program that really was a tribute to his life and his work, and not just a single film. So we tried to take our time, but we also wanted to do it pretty quickly.
Yeah, you came up with this pretty quickly. Why these particular films?
One of the things I think is so important about Gene Wilder is that he's remembered for his comedy, but he was so much more than just a comedian. He was an incredibly thoughtful actor, and I think these films in particular showcase that range of his work. Obviously, the laughs are there. You have The Producers. You have some of his great comedic moments, but you also have his signature role with Willy Wonka, which was so much about, I think the director of that film, Mel Stewart, called it the most challenging role, because he had to be both scary and sort of fearful, but also a trustworthy figure. And he showed his ability as an actor, not just as a comedian. So I think these four films really sort of span the range of Gene Wilder's talent.
It's kind of amazing to realize that he studied at the Actor's Studio with Lee Strasberg and with Herbert Berghoff. And he originally thought of himself as a dramatic actor.
Yes, he changed his name because he aspired to play Hamlet and thought Jerome Silberman as Hamlet didn't look great on a theater marquee.
And then he later admitted that Gene Wilder as Hamlet also didn't seem to work.
No.
He starts out on Broadway. He's done a little bit on television. But, he gets his real breakthrough in terms of movies in a small part in Bonnie and Clyde, the great film produced by Warren Beatty, directed by Arthur Penn, Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway. And he plays one of the people who are kidnapped by Bonnie and Clyde with his fiance. They're necking on the porch. And it's just a hilarious sequence of scenes as he conveys through those big blue eyes and that frizzy blonde hair his mounting terror at the fact of, who he's riding with. And then they share hamburgers and get comfortable. And then it's terror again.
Well, we're skipping around, and we will have fun going from film to film. But since you mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, that began his film career in 1967. And the following year, he appeared in The Producers with Mel Brooks. That made him famous. He was the Schlemiel accountant, Leo Bloom, to Zero Mostel's Max Bialystok. It took an actor of Gene Wilder's talent, of that level of artistry, to match a scenery chomper like Zero Mostel.
Yeah.
And Matthew, you have chosen a clip from The Producers. Let's listen.
I'm hysterical. I can't stop when I get like this. I can't stop. I'm hysterical. I'm wet. I'm wet. I'm hysterical and I'm wet. I'm in pain. And I'm wet. And I'm still hysterical! No, no, don't hit. It doesn't help. It only increases my sense of danger.
What can I do? What can I do? You can't make me hysterical.
Go away. You frighten me.
Yeah, an amazing scene. And really hard to imagine another actor pulling off what Gene Wilder did. I mean, actually, when you think of Wilder in general, who is his heir? It's really impossible. Some people have suggested Johnny Depp, maybe in certain roles, but it's just that zaniness, that willingness to go to such extremes, like in this scene in The Producers, where he puts all his neuroses on display. And yet at the same time, we shouldn't forget that he was also capable of doing very quiet moments in contrast to this neurotic hysteria that he so excelled at.
Yeah, beautiful, quiet moments.
He once said, my quiet exterior used to be a mask for hysteria. After 7 years of analysis, it just became a habit. So
He was so thoughtful about his roles. I mean, that scene is so hilarious. What people would not know is it was shot at the end of a very long day, and Gene was tired, and he said to Mel Brooks, he said, I can't do it. I just can't shoot this today. He said, I don't have it in me. And Mel Brooks, being Mel Brooks, just said, don't worry about it. And he literally, I think he brought him a couple of cups of coffee, a couple of chocolate bars, maybe got him some soda. He literally just loaded him up with caffeine and sugar and said, you can do it. And he did it. But he was always that way. He was always very conscious and very thoughtful and very, am I able to give what I need to give? And that relationship he had, not with the camera, but the people on the other side of it who are going to be watching the
Indeed.
Final product.
And, you know, that's the thing about comedy. We're so swept up in the joy and the humor that it seems effortless when you have artists like this. But, in fact, you mentioned his classical training. A serious actor, in fact, he met Mel Brooks through Mel Brooks's wife, Anne Bancroft, while Gene Wilder was performing in a role in a play by Bertolt Brecht, Mother Courage and Her Children. And Anne Bancroft thought he would really enjoy meeting her husband. Well, I don't know if they were married at that point, but indeed that's how Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder became close friends. Gene Wilder's mother was in frail health as a young woman. I think actually all her life she had rheumatic fever as a child and complications. And I read that at the age of 8, the doctor turned to the little boy and said, don't ever argue with your mother. You might kill her. Try to make her laugh. No shortage of responsibility to place upon a little boy. He did make her laugh a lot with impersonations and his imitating funny accents, but it was serious theater that marked his early career. And I think in the films you showcase on Sunday, probably Willy Wonka calls upon the greatest of that dramatic range. Do you agree, Brad?
I do. I mean, like I said, I think it's the hardest role you could possibly have. And when they were casting for that role, they really struggled because they needed a guy who could sing, who could dance, who could play the part and be that manic, crazy character that you both looked up to and had some trust for, but also were scared of. And what Gene said about that role, I think, is perfect. He said later on in an interview that he was very much aware of the fact that as an actor, you're lying. You're lying to the audience, and the audience knows you're lying to them. And many actors will sort of find a way to wink at the audience because maybe their ego demands it. But for him, he said, I went into that role, and I wanted to lie, period, full stop, that was it. And I wanted never to wink and never to let anyone know when I was lying and how much I was lying. And he accomplished that. There's the phenomenal scene in the tunnel. And he literally scared the kids he was working with to the point where they would go to the director and say, we think he's crazy.
He's
really
going to turn us into a blueberry.
Yes. And he achieved that. He achieved it with his actors that he was working with. He achieved it with the audience. And I don't know that there's another actor who could have done that role. And certainly the director sort of ticked off the producers of that film, because when he met with Gene Wilder for the casting session, he ended up running down the hall and saying, "You have to play this part." And the producers were all like, "You've just destroyed all of our leverage in negotiating a deal with this guy." But he was that perfect for the role. Mm-hmm. And he had to be smart about it. And he had to think about how to walk a very fine line.
Let's listen to which clip from Willy Wonka would you like to hear?
I'm not sure which one we actually picked.
Wait a minute. Must show you this. Lickable wallpaper for nursery walls. Lick an orange. It tastes like an orange. Lick a pineapple. It tastes like a pineapple. Go ahead. Try it.
Oh. I got a plum.
Grandpa, this banana's fantastic. It tastes so real.
Try some more. The strawberries taste like strawberries. The snozzberries taste like snozzberries.
Snozzberries? Who ever heard of a snozzberry?
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
We are the music makers. We are the dreamers. I mean, that's the way that he delivers that line in that film. You know, I was always struck by, everyone sort of talks about how manic he could get. And certainly there is probably no actor ever who's used his hair to such great effect. But in that movie, what really lands are those soft moments when he just quietly delivers those lines. There's that line at the end. There's another line in the film when he's talking to about where the Oompa Loompas come from. And one of the parents is, "I'm a geography teacher." And he without missing a beat, he just sort of very quietly goes, "Oh, then you know where the Oompa land is." He just had that ability to sort of throw these very soft lines that were normal and that were so delightful. And they gave the contrast that you needed for the manic stuff to work.
We have a quiet line from Blazing Saddles, where he introduces himself.
What's your name?
Well, my name is Jim, but most people call me Jim.
Okay.
Okay, Jim.
I would say the world's greatest conductors could not have measured those beats more precisely than he did in the way he delivered that quiet moment. Frisco Kid is in your lineup for Sunday, and that was not a film he made with Mel Brooks. It was a movie he did in 1979 about a Polish rabbi who wanders through the Old West on his way to lead a synagogue in San Francisco. Tell us more.
And it's obviously his most overtly Jewish film. I don't know that it's necessarily in spirit the most Jewish of his films, but it's he plays a rabbi, and it's great. It's fun to see him play against an actor like Harrison Ford, who's such a sort of straight actor and
a movie star.
And he's a movie star.
Yeah,
yes.
We're not talking theater cred like Gene Wilder and Zero Miles to
Elia. No, and you know, but he made it work. I that's something that I don't think can ever be said enough about Gene Wilder. As an actor, he was a wonderful collaborator, and he put a lot of emphasis in his work, and he talked about it in his interviews about the partnership he had with his fellow actors and about the partnership he had with his fellow filmmakers in order to achieve what ended up on the screen. I mean, you talked about the beats and the greatest conductor couldn't. Part of that was just finding the rhythm and finding how to make it work with the other actors, whether it was a child actor, whether it was a movie star, didn't matter. He understood that, and that's something that, you know, I think all actors appreciate, an actor that is willing to sort of bend and flex and work and collaborate, and he did that. And you saw his ability to do that when you get to Frisco Kid. He is Gene Wilder by that point. Some of these films are from earlier on. He wasn't Gene Wilder yet. Mm-hmm. And he was able to work with someone like Harrison Ford and really, I think, pull stuff out of Harrison Ford that another actor might not have been able to pull. Harrison Ford's a great actor, but he was, you know, he was a different kind of performer. He came from a different back. He wasn't a trained. He wasn't classically. You know, he was a carpenter. And then he became an actor. So that, to me, is the real delight of watching Frisco Kid, is watching the craft that a veteran Gene Wilder was bringing to the screen.
Blazing Saddles is my favorite movie of all time. all time.
Good choice.
Forget Citizen Kane, keep Casablanca. Okay, I won't go on too much longer on that. But 2 years ago, NPR ran a story, part of its Code Switch series. And this was in celebration of the 40th anniversary of Blazing Saddles. NPR referenced it as a milestone in race relations depicted on screen. I don't think that's overstating it. And here's why I think it's valid. In the scene we're about to hear, Gene Wilder is in as close a close-up. I mean, virtually, his face and that of the actor Cleavon Little fill the entire screen. And Cleavon Little, as Bart is trying to console Cleavon Little, I should add, as African-American, yes. As Bart, yes. At the end of his first day as sheriff, in total despair, a study in despair, as Gene Wilder tries to console him.
What did you expect? Welcome, Sonny. Make yourself at home. Marry my daughter. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons.
Okay. Tell me that in Rosebud?
Yeah.
Come on. Which would you do? So
that was actually after Gene passed. There were all the memes floating around online and these little animated GIFs. That was my favorite because that was... Because of the end, you have that laugh, you have that bit of, and there was no, it didn't have the dialogue, it just had the play, and it showed up on a bunch of different places that I saw, and I was like, that's perfect, because it's what he was able to do. He was able to sort of interact, and you have this sort of, the face that Cleavon Little has, and then all of a sudden it cracks, and that was what Gene could do. That was the best way to remember him.
Well, that clip also gets at the heart of the film. Well, the film's doing a lot of things simultaneously. It's an incredible spoof on Westerns and showing things that Westerns would never have shown before. Part of a movement in that period in Hollywood to play with traditional genre conventions. But the film is also a very funny condemnation of racism in all its manifestations. And so that scene, it just sort of gets to the heart of it. And it's just extremely outrageous in its use of the N-word and everything else. And it's just very upfront and out there.
No one is spared.
Nobody is. But that's also part of its power. And that really gets to what Mel Brooks was trying to do in that movie. Mm. And it's also a function of what was going on in American movie making in the late 60s and early 70s, that this embrace of ethnicity that you hadn't seen in films before that were pretty smoothed out and really bringing it to the foreground. And that's part of its great achievement, in addition to being just hilarious. It was all my friends talked about at school mm-hmm. when it came out. I was delayed in getting to see it. But I pretty much knew the film by heart based on what they told me.
I
Ben heard of spoiler alerts back then.
No. Spoiler alert. Oh, poor Matthew. Well, if some of you can imagine a time before video, I mean, VCRs, much less on-demand viewing DVDs. I saw Blazing Saddles 5 times in the first month it was out.
Wow.
And I'm going to see it again Sunday when you yes. screen it
yes.
at the LaFont Sandy Springs. In just the minute we have left, I was wondering if you could talk about this tenderness, this gentleness that we hear so much about his personal interaction, how that might have informed his work. You mentioned the collaboration, Brad. Do you think it took someone of his disposition to pull this off?
Yeah, I absolutely. You know, one of the things is whatever Gene Wilder is doing, and no matter how zany or no matter how ridiculous the circumstances he's in, he had this ability to make the viewer connect with his character. I even think of a, a relatively minor film. It's not well remembered, but he acted with Zero Mostel in a film version of Eugene Ionesco's Rhinoceros, in which everyone around Gene Wilder is turning into a rhinoceros, including Karen Black, his fiance. whatever the situation, though, you always connect with him on a human level, and that's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I think you can't take anything away from his respect for his fellow humanity, big and small.
Yeah.
People would approach him, parents with their children, because he was Willy Wonka.
Yes.
And, you know, there was a great story of he was shopping in the grocery store, and the woman walked up, and she had her son. And this is in the late 70s, and she says, she whispers to him, can I tell him who you are? And he knows what she's about to do, and he goes, yes, but you have to be very quiet about it. And he sort of knelt down, and she said, this is Willy Wonka, and the child was like, wow. But he understood the connection, and he respected the connection, and he carried that into his personal life. He carried that into his relationship with his wife. He carried it into his relationships with people outside of work. He's just a man of incredible heart, and that's the thing that we like to celebrate. The films are fantastic, and there's nothing like seeing them on the big screen.
Yes.
Yeah.
With a big room full of others hysterically
the
laughing
best way
and
to
rolling
see them.
In the aisles.
Yeah. Best way to see them.
Well, Brad Pilcher is the Associate Director of the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival, and Professor Matthew Bernstein is Chair of Film and Media Studies at Emory University. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lois, for having us.
The AJFF tribute to Gene Wilder is Sunday at LaFont Theater, Sandy Springs. There will be more information on our website later. wabe.org/citylights.